Hey everyone, if you like this podcast, go behind the paywall to get privileged access to the smartest minds in finance. Join the Real Vision community and learn how to become a better investor. Visit realvision.com/RVPod and use the promo code PODCAST10, that's PODCAST10, to get 10% off our essential membership for the first year. Now, to the top analysis of today's crypto markets.
Hopes raised for FTX creditors, new management reportedly growing more optimistic about how much money can be recovered. Welcome back to Real Vision Crypto Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington. I'll discuss this and more with a former Fed economist turned investor, Joe Chow. Welcome back to the show, Joe.
Good to be with you again, Ash.
It's great to have you here. Before we get to the interview, let's take a look at our latest price analysis. We're starting with some all-important macroeconomic news, propitious coincidence that we have Joe here to discuss it. The U.S. economy grew by 2.9% in the fourth quarter of 2022 on an annualized basis. There's a slightly lower GDP growth than in the previous quarter. Major cryptocurrencies appear to be reacting well to the news. This could be because the slowing growth means the Fed might slow down the pace of its rate hikes. Bitcoin price has been reacting positively lately whenever it seems the Fed will be less hawkish going forward. Speaking of Bitcoin, it has regained the $23,000 threshold. It's up 2.5% on a 24-hour basis. We saw Bitcoin hit a new multi-month high of $23,700 on Wednesday. Meanwhile, Ether has snapped out of its recent underperformance streak relative to Bitcoin. Ether is up more than 4% on a 24-hour basis. It's back above $1,600 after dipping to $1,530 on Wednesday. We're also keeping an eye on BUSD, that's Binance's stablecoin. According to data from CoinGecko cited by CoinDesk, the supply of BUSD fell by $1 billion over the past week. It has suffered a decline of 30% since early December, as questions over fund management at Binance continue to swirl. One final token we're looking at today is Aptos, the project founded by former Meta engineers, continues to attract attention after a sloppy start. Today's rally has extended its weekly gains by a whopping 130% on a trailing seven-day basis. Obviously, some pretty significant momentum there. Okay, viewers, it's time to join the conversation. Put down your questions in the chat wherever you're watching. We'll ask the best ones later on this show. Remember, Real Vision members take priority, but the good news is membership is free. With that said, let's bring in our guest. Joe Chow is a former Fed economist. He's now a partner at Millennia Capital. Joe, welcome back to Real Vision Crypto. Pleasure to have you here as always, man.
Good to see you, Ash. Hope you're having a great start to the day.
I am indeed. Joe, macroeconomic news is right in your wheelhouse. As a former Fed economist, what's your take on this slowing GDP data?
Yeah, so I was listening, you know, to the radio reading the news this morning. So the data is actually an interesting one because in 2022, in the first four quarters, we had two negative quarters of negative GDP. So that was Q1, Q2. Then Q3, we had a pretty strong number, as you can see here in the chart. Q4, the number kind of slowed down. And so what that really means for Fed policy, I think, is really a few folds. One is, I think this number is a good number because it increases the odds of a soft landing. What that means is perhaps the economy was so strong that even though the Fed sort of suddenly breaks on the economy and raise rates at the fastest pace in decades, the underlying economy is actually doing okay. And what that means is whether it's for corporate earnings, whether it's for business and consumer balance sheet, at least in the economy in Q4 was doing fine. Some of the, commentators were fearing that, we might be heading into a severe recession. I think in all likelihood, this number rules out that possibility. And I think this number just adds in a lot of weight to the possibility that we may be in a recession. We're definitely in a market reset, but if we're in a recession in Q1 or Q2 of this year, 2023, it would be softer because, for example, we're going from 2.9, let's say we go down to a negative number, because there's enough of a buffer, right, 2.9, the chances of Q1 or Q2 GDP being in a positive territory or slightly negative is much higher than if, let's say, we're at 0.1% going to like negative 4. So that's what it means for economics. And then for Fed policy, I would say all things equal, this number would add a little bit more probability to the odds that they might raise 50. But I still think that right now, both the Fed and the market seem to think that the Fed's on track to raise another 25 bips in the meeting next week. But this number definitely gives a little bit more room to the Fed to sort of tighten a little bit further. I think we're in this market environment where bad news, good economic news is bad news for the markets, because good economic news means the Fed is going to tighten further, which, you know, would just kind of put more downward pressure on the risk assets, including NASDAQ stocks, S&P, and crypto prices.
Yeah, those who have been watching markets for a while know this weird upside down world of bad news is good news with regard to the Fed and what might be happening. But Joe, I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but it sounds as though you're giving this almost a Goldilocks scenario. It sounds as though you think this is this kind of perfect balance here that the Fed can sort of maintain. By the way, while we're talking about this, we should put up a chart to take a look at the other side of the equation, the other side of the Scylla and Charybdis that the Fed is trying to steer between. What you're looking at right now is the 12-month percent change consumer price index, not seasonally adjusted. And this is all items that we're looking at here. So Joe, we know what the problem is. Those who have been watching this show, of course, certainly do. And that's the fact that inflation has been far, far too high, heading up near the double digits at peak. Give us your take on this chart and the broader context on inflation.
Yeah, so I think starting with the December numbers that and these numbers came out in the last few weeks, I feel investor sentiment has really improved. And you see that both in public and private markets. So I operate mostly in private markets now. And you know, when I work with other funds and when I work with brokers, what I'm hearing is that there's more buyers coming back into the market in the private markets. And that includes private equity, venture capital, et cetera. Now, in public markets, we're seeing pretty good strength in the broader equity markets. So I think that's a reflection of the investor sentiment improving, which I think is a reflection of the fact that we've probably seen the worst of in inflation. When December, some of the inflation numbers, the month over month change, which is basically if a dollar, actually went down to like 99 cents, even it was a negative month over month inflation number became a negative number. I think that number really gave a lot of confidence to market watchers that the worst of inflation is over. We've seen peak inflation last year, inflation is going down. And if inflation was the root of all evils, then if the root cause goes away, then you can sort of speculate that extrapolate that these symptoms might become better. So 2022, we saw peak inflation, now inflation is going down. So that's the good news. And that's why you're seeing more buyers come to the market, because now, whether it's investor sentiment that's improving, whether it's treasury yields and those numbers kind of coming down, moderating, and that's just adding a little bit more sentiment towards risk investors, equity investors, crypto investors. In terms of outlook wise, I think the concern for most economists and investors is sort of where inflation is going to end up. Because right now inflation is still running at very elevated levels. They are we've seen the worst of it. It's come down, but it hasn't gone back to normal. A normal inflation is 2-3%. That's what the Fed would like to see. So basically, the way to think about Fed policy and inflation is the Federal Reserve would like to keep its benchmark rate at about 50 basis points higher than the average inflation. So right now, for example, inflation is now down to core inflation is down to what, in the 4-5% range. The goal, and I think based on the Fed's forecast and some of the Wall Street economists' forecasts, maybe inflation has peaked, but it's going down. So depending on when that inflation goes back to sort of that zone of 2-3%, that's where the Fed might begin to sort of pivot and cut rates. So the question really is, we know inflation is going down. The question is, how fast is it going down, and when is it going back to the normal zone? And that's probably when you see the end of the tunnel for this Fed tightening cycle.
Joe, I think it's such a pleasure to have you here and give our audience this perspective. Obviously, when you speak about this, you sound like a former policymaker. You sound like a guy who was in the room at the Fed hashing through this. You actually worked, I believe, for Paul Volcker, which is shocking to a guy so young could have been there. But you were actually Paul Volcker's assistant as a former chairman or emeritus chairman at the Fed. Is that right?
Worked on a project with them, yeah, before in a few years ago.
Yeah, so you were kind of in the room around all this talk. What I want to pivot to a little bit now is hearing about what you're doing today in private markets and how this sort of background context influences your view of what you do today in private markets.
Yeah, so what I focus on is mostly private markets, technology, software, AI companies, fintech, blockchain, Web3, et cetera. So I think the biggest application is valuations of startups, of Web3 blockchain companies, of private companies are all subject to macroeconomic changes. Now, some of the valuation numbers of private startups don't change on a day-to-day basis. Well, in crypto, it does change every day.
Right.
So
you effectively have created instant liquidity in these markets through the technology of digital assets. So where venture stakes might have not moved from their marks for months on end, now you have the ability to get a price on something on really a nanosecond by nanosecond basis.
Right. So I think one of the things I do is, even though some of the private company valuations don't change on a day-to-day basis because they're booked to market, they're the marks of the book value, you can really sort of figure out what the fair value is based on income economic data. So for example, one of the things the Fed really does really well is they have a trading desk in New York where every day they monitor fixed income equity markets. When incoming data changes, some of the default rates like treasury yields sort of change, sort of both the Fed and the Wall Street trading desk sort of try to price what is fair value based on the economic data. Well, in the private markets, that is not even an industry that's been developed. Most of it, everything is sort of held static. For me, I try to sort of leverage that experience to underwrite what is fair value in private markets. And so what that really means is, in terms of my own thesis on investing in the market is, when we look at sort of valuations in the private market, whether it's private companies, pre-IPO, early stage, we can sort of apply a macroeconomic framework and a public markets discipline to evaluating private startups. So I'll give you a concrete example. Software startups like cybersecurity and things like Salesforce and SaaS business models historically trade about 8 to 10 times revenue. And that applies to Web3 companies. These companies have 80% gross margins, they trade at 10 times revenue. Well, what happens, and that corresponds with a default Fed funds rate of 2.5%, which is the average for the last 10 years since the GFC, and then this is sort of the multiple. When multiples kind of went down, when the default rate went down, because the Fed was lowering rates to kind of juice the economy, multiples went up. And now when the Fed funds rate has gone up to almost 5%, multiples have contracted, and that's what explains sort of the correction we see in asset prices. So there are ways to sort of underwrite what is fair value and play kind of an active strategy in private markets based on sort of economic data. So you connect private markets with sort of economic income data.
So essentially the transmission mechanism here is through the credit cycle relative to the economic cycle, or rather the adjustments that the Fed is making with regard to prime rates and other pieces of the macroeconomic policy toolkit have this impact that you see follow through the credit cycle, availability of credit, and therefore the asset pricing model that takes as one of its primary inputs the rate of interest.
That's right. So basically, I would call 3 to 4 layers of rates. The first layer, I guess you can think of, you can actually use an analogy in sort of Web3, right? So layer one would be the Fed funds rate, and that's controlled by the FOMC. Layer two, you can call that the treasury yield curve. That's 5-year treasury, 10-year treasury, 30-year treasury, 6 months. So when layer one moves, layer two is going to move. Layer three would be other rates like mortgage-backed securities, would be like private credit yields. So when the Fed moves, it takes a while, kind of usually a few days, for the second layer to kind of fully adjust. And then it might take a bit longer, maybe a month or two, for the third layer, the private credit market, the public credit market, the mortgage-backed securities, that market to kind of adjust. And then the fourth layer is the impact of that on equities. And then, based on that transmission, that's going to affect the values of the both public and private equities.
You're speaking my language, Joe. My brain automatically thinks in abstraction layers. I think it's all the time I spent doing tech work early in my career. We're going to have you back to do a capital asset pricing model tutorial for our audience. But it is, I think, important for people to understand a little bit of the framework here. Because what's interesting to me, and it's such a great coincidence that we have you here today to talk about this, is we had this period where we saw all this negative news in the space in terms of default. And what we had, default risk, I should say, because we saw some negative stories coming out about Binance, about Digital Currency Group and some of its subsidiaries. And yet, And yet, we had price moving in the opposite direction of what you would predict. Why? Because of expectations of inflation data and therefore the macroeconomic policy response of the Fed and other global central banks. And I think it was puzzling to a lot of people in the space who looked at this and said, well, I don't get it, right? We see all this negative news and yet prices are going up. And I think you've just articulated very clearly the model for why that's so.
Exactly. I would say the biggest thing that folks need to realize is that the stock market, the S&P, the NASDAQ, and just stocks are a forward-looking machine of what the economic environment and the rate environment is going to look like in the next 6 to 12 months. So you know, even today's GDP data that came out was a lagging indicator describing what happened last year. But the market is looking ahead. And I think that applies to both, you know, assets like Bitcoin, Ethereum, and assets like the stock market. So really, I think what the reason I think you're seeing like an improvement in investor risk sentiment is because we've seen negative inflation for the first time in December, month over month, and inflation is going down, and the street and market participants are extrapolating that in the next 6 to 12 months, if this sort of trend continues, then what does that mean for Fed policy? And what the market seems to think is that based on this trend, the market is pricing in a lower inflation and the Fed might even pause or pivot. And that I think is what's driving investor sentiment and improvements in the last, since the beginning of the year.
We'll add DCF analysis to the future tutorial, Joe. I want to pivot back to something that we were just talking about in terms of this negative news, because we have some new news out today on FTX. Hopes have been raised by the new management of bankrupt cryptocurrency exchange FTX. According to sources speaking exclusively to the New York Post, Wall Street executives representing FTX creditors are growing increasingly optimistic about fund recovery. We actually have Charlie Gasparino, who broke the story, booked on the show for a week from today, so we get to talk to him about that. According to the Post, the CEO of FTX, the new CEO, I should say, John Wray, obviously replacing Sam Bankman-Fried, could recover as much as two-thirds of the approximately $8 billion lost by FTX. That's because he was able to find around $5 billion worth of liquid assets. Obviously, that's a non-trivial sum. That's good news, of course, particularly for creditors and for users of that platform. The bad news is that the recovery could take as long as 2 years. Also, valuing many of these assets may be quite challenging. Those assets include illiquid cryptocurrencies or venture capital. We've also learned the full list of FTX creditors for the first time. Decrypt says court documents reveal the creditors include tech companies such as Apple, Netflix, and WeWork, to competitors like CoinDesk and even news outlets like the Wall Street Journal and CoinDesk. Joe, you know, obviously this is a story that has been dominating news cycles. It's literally the story that people who know nothing about cryptocurrency ask me about when people hear what I do for a living. Joe, what's your take on FTX and more broadly on what the impact has been in private markets because of this spectacular collapse?
Well, first of all, it's really unfortunate news. And I hope, you know, investors and customers are doing okay. I would say in terms of impact, we're seeing a lot of repercussions in the private markets since this event unfolded late last year. One is, let's break it down by sort of stakeholders. So now when it comes to, first of all, when it comes to the existing investors that are in this in FTX, you're seeing a few of them have written apology letters to their investors and even and have some of which have been released publicly. And so you're seeing these firms heightening their internal due diligence criteria. And I think out for investors that were not in FTX, so for example, my firm, we were not investors in FTX, and other investment firms, everybody is also kind of heightening their own due diligence criteria. So I think this really has sort of sent a shock to the investment community. Now, when it comes to the customers, obviously, it would be great if customers can sort of recover as much as possible. I think some of the process here involved include, one, I've seen some of the reports on some of the holdings by Alameda. You know, Alameda has invested in, you know, dozens and dozens of different investments, some of which were investments in funds, in companies. So it will, by the way,
for anyone who may not know, Alameda, of course, was the sister company of FTX that essentially was making prop bets, making speculative bets about the future of various protocols and also venture capital bets, apparently, and things that were illiquid. So this is the challenge, and they seem to have shared balance sheet exposure, and that's the background context. I guess I should say allegedly, according to
allegedly.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone, we're going to take a quick pause and hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, so what would happen in this case is if the investment dollars into venture capital funds and startups can be recovered, then they can be sort of moved back onto FTX's balance sheet and then be distributed back to the creditors, the customers. I think some of those investments will unfortunately not be able to be recovered. The reason is, for example, if let's say Alameda, FTX's, you know, sister organization, had invested in a venture capital fund, and the fund is willing to return that dollar money one for one, then 100% of that investment will be returned to FTX's balance sheet, and then which would be made available to the creditors. However, if let's say Alameda made an investment in a cryptocurrency, let's say when it was trading at $100, and now the market value has gone to $10, unfortunately, that will probably not be fully recovered. And so it looks like, you know, this amount of recovery is likely from those investments where the money can still be kind of recovered, whether it was a kind of fund investment, a liquid investment where the value hasn't really changed and folks are willing to, kind of return the funds.
Yeah. I noticed that Paul English in one of the chats on Real Vision website is pointing out this question about what's happening right now in terms of the layoffs in the space. It just so happens our next story, Paul, is about exactly that. The London-based exchange Luno is cutting 35% of its global staff. Obviously, that's a big number. According to Forecast News, this means around 340 workers will be affected. Here's the point that most people need to know. Luna is a subsidiary of the troubled cryptocurrency conglomerate DCG, that's Digital Currency Group, Barry Silbert's shop, that also owns Genesis, that also owns Grayscale Investments, which controls GBTC, and also owns CoinDesk. In a note to employees shared partially on the Luna website, CEO Marcus Swanpoel blamed, quote, unforeseen and very extreme events in the industry. This gets back into the broader conditions that we've been talking about here. He said the sheer scale and speed of the events means even planned mitigating measures were not enough. Swanpoel said the notable crypto collapses created, quote, a significantly more constrained funding environment with the markets shifting from long-term investments to shorter-term profitability. And by the way, we could also add the broader macroeconomic conditions, contraction of credit and contraction of financial conditions. He also blamed, quote, negative market impact on market sentiment and consequently on growth and revenue for our business, along with our peers and our competitors. Boy, part and parcel of the same conversation we've been having here, Joe.
Yeah, it's probably a reflection of both the declining kind of crypto asset prices and also a tougher funding environment, because my hypothesis would be before, when rates were near zero, when the layer one rate was near zero and the layer two, like treasury yields, were also near zero, you could borrow a layer three, you know, in the private credit, public credit market for like a really good rate, let's call it 3-4%. Now the layer one rate, the Fed rate is almost up to 5%, and the Treasury is up to 4 to 5%. And so some of the private lending rates have gone up to 12%. And that's like a really, really expensive rate to borrow. I think secondly, in a tougher economic environment, the lenders are also doing two things. One is not only are they charging more, which makes it more expensive to borrow, but they're also not lending as much because they have to, in a recessionary environment, there's an indicator that the Fed tracks. It's called a default rate on default rate of the underlying kind of borrowers. So what the lenders are doing is they're you know, pricing a higher probability that some of these borrowers might go bankrupt, and that's probably why they're also not lending out credit. And so, you know, when you got a double whammy like that, it's hard for companies to borrow credit. And I think when you combine the fact that a lot of customers are probably withdrawing their amount from the platform, I think that's why there's a lot of financial pressure on these organizations. You know, if you know, what I've been kind of talking to other investment firms in the industry about is, so this is obviously a huge reset in tech and in Web3. If a company can survive this winter, it'll probably come out the other side stronger. So, and a key to surviving this winter is, one, to have enough of a balance sheet of a lot of cash, B, to cut down the burn rate so that you can sort of still make payroll and then, you know, sort of last long enough for the market to recover.
Right. Hey, Joe, you said double whammy. How about a triple whammy? One of the space's significant challenges in terms of headwinds that they're facing in the wake of FTX is additional regulatory headwinds. U.S. Democratic Senator and longtime crypto critic Elizabeth Warren has warned more industry failures will happen unless regulation is toughened up. She said, quote, "For all their talk of innovation and financial inclusion, crypto industry giants from FTX to Celsius to Voyager are collapsing under the weight of their own fraud, deceit, and gross mismanagement. And when they sink, they take a lot of honest investors down with them," close quote. Well, you know, this is an interesting story here. Obviously, there's certainly some truth to that, but you have to wonder about the broader context of what's going to happen in the industry, particularly if the sort of regulatory framework that comes is one that isn't as thoughtful as maybe it could be. I should say Warren called on regulators, including the Securities Exchange Commission and banking authorities, to double down on the tools they already have. This is such a delicate balancing act, Joe. We want to protect investors, obviously. We want to make sure that people who are bad actors in the space who commit fraud are prosecuted. And yet at the same time, the risk is this sort of broader headwind to the space, maybe not targeted as well as it could be. These are very complex, very new technologies, very challenging to regulate in a way that maintains investor protections and yet also maintains an environment where you can have this kind of growth and creative sort of development of new technology. What's your thought on this, particularly in relation to the potential headwind in the private markets from regulatory moves?
Yeah, so, you know, I've been a student of, you know, business and financial markets history. It's a pattern where innovation always outpaces regulation and regulators right. have to catch up. So what happened this episode is nothing new to what happened decades ago, if you look back in instances. So so I think what's certain is that regulations are coming. I think some of the things we've seen will heighten the pace at which the regulators are going to come out. The government's going to come up with regulations. So I think that's a good thing because that's going to put more legal framework around this industry. And once there's clear guidelines for this industry, once regulations catches up with innovation, I think that's going to invite more innovators and institutions to come into the industry. You know, our view, and I think the view of other investment firms, is that this industry is here to stay. It's just going through a very painful reset. And so, you know, there will be survivors, out of this sort of market reset in Web3. And there will be regulations coming. So it would be good if the companies that survive and the new ones will kind of build themselves around the framework. And I think that's going to really help this industry mature. Right. This is what happened, you know, historically, you know, in the last century. So it's nothing new. It's sort of a pattern that's repeating.
Yeah, it's so true. It's such an important and nuanced point, Joe. The more things change, the more they remain the same. I was just grousing earlier this morning. I tried to open a meeting in Microsoft Outlook, and it automatically kicked me into Teams instead of Zoom. And I pointed out that this is precisely the kind of bundling challenge that got Microsoft into trouble, or at least analogous to the kind of bundling decision that got Microsoft into trouble back in the late 1990s. And remember, Microsoft was nearly broken up. A judge named Penfield Jackson issued a ruling that was going to break Microsoft into three distinct companies. Ultimately, it was overturned on appeal. It's a very complicated process. I guess what's different here today is that effectively these technologies are also financial products, or resemble financial products, resemble securities in some cases. And so the regulatory framework around it becomes that much more complicated from a legal perspective, from a regulatory perspective. We have kind of fragmented regulation and oversight here in the US compared to something like the UK, which has one principal regulator. Some people believe that's a benefit. You have things regulated at the state level, you have banks regulated at the federal level. It's a really complex mosaic of regulation here. And when you add this sort of direct financial component, we were talking about this earlier with the liquidity in private markets, essentially you can get a price on a venture capital investment, or de facto venture capital investment in terms of the way it performs, in seconds, rather than something you might not get a price. You'd have to call a guy like Joe Chow and say, hey Joe, what's the value of this? Now you just see it on your screen. You can go to CoinMarketCap, you can go to CoinGecko, and you get a price.
That's right. And so, you know, our hope is that the regulations will be clear, and will provide clear guidelines to innovators on how to build Web3 innovations. You know, I just want to bring up something that, you know, has been top of our priorities is this whole AI buzz. Right now there's, you know, the tech industry is going through a pretty painful reset. But amongst all of this, you know, AI seems to be the next sort of platform for innovation. And so in fact, you know, I've met with several entrepreneurs recently who are saying that they're now building new companies on top of OpenAI's platform. Right. So I think what that shows is, yes, like we're going through a market reset, both in tech and Web3. But at the same time, as long as the technology is, the platform is legitimate and solid, OpenAI becoming sort of a newer platform, it's going to allow a lot of new companies to be built on top of that platform. By the same token, I think when, you know, we come out of the reset, when blockchain becomes a more mature industry, it's going to be a new platform that allows many new companies to be built on blockchain. And you know, you could even argue the AI platform and the blockchain platform can work together, and there'll be cross integration between blockchain and AI. And there's going to be a lot of innovations and companies being built between these two platforms. So despite the market reset, you know, I think if you're an optimist, which I am, and entrepreneurs are, there's a lot of things to be excited about.
Joe, let me ask you this. What are some of those overlaps? What might some of those synergies be between AI, which is something that fascinates me and I know fascinates you, we've been talking about it here on Real Vision, and the digital asset, cryptocurrency, blockchain space?
Yeah, so let me start with some of the things I've been hearing from entrepreneurs on the OpenAI sort of front. So OpenAI is basically, innovation has matured to a point where this AI platform can be integrated with existing solutions and be distributed to like business and consumers. So one of the reasons Microsoft invested, you know, you can sort of, you know, read some of their press releases and their earnings call transcripts, is Microsoft plans to not only invest in OpenAI, which they have invested, but they also plan to integrate that AI solution to some of their enterprise applications, whether it's Office, whether it's Teams. And so the AI is going to do many things to augment kind of human work. So, and there's a lot of startups right now. I just met one that's in fintech, where they're trying to build their fintech platform, their underwriting platform, on top of the OpenAI platform. And so you're seeing a lot of entrepreneurs rebuilding technologies being built on AI, on OpenAI. So you can sort of think of, like, you know, in the last 10 years, we had cloud, and AWS and Google became big cloud providers. Now there's a lot of cloud-based companies, Snowflake, what have you. By the same token, now there's an AI platform. And a lot of startups, a lot of innovators are building new applications and software on top of AI. And blockchain is I think the next sort of generation of it's one of the next innovations to mature, and there will be many new applications being built on the blockchain. Now, to what extent they interact, I think will be what the innovators will do. But I think we're seeing, if we saw the internet in the 2000s, the 1990s as sort of one example instance of that, the cloud being another example of that, and I think AI is next, and then the next is blockchain. So I think there's a lot of opportunity in the market, and despite the market fluctuations, I think I would just look at the fundamentals of these businesses and determine determine investments via that channel.
One of the novel applications I heard for artificial intelligence in the blockchain distributed asset digital tech space is the idea of doing code audits to effectively attempt to find security flaws within smart contracts. I guess that sort of works in the opposite direction as well, because the bad actors will have that technology to search for vulnerabilities. But it is sort of interesting to think about just some of the ways that we might have the overlap between digital assets and AI, which certainly seems to be coming, as though you point out, it's always challenging to see in advance exactly what that leading technology is going to be that causes that dovetail.
So a lot of VCs, and myself included, are now hunting for ideas and entrepreneurs and opportunities where you can invest at the intersection of AI and blockchain. And I suspect that you'll hear many, many more new buzzwords in the coming 2 to 5 to 10 years of things that will develop within these two new platforms.
Well, we can virtually guarantee it's going to be in the pitch decks before that. Whether or not it will actually be realized in the next 6 months or so, that remains to be seen. But I'm sure it's going to be a topic we're going to be hearing more about. I should say, Joe, it's nearly time for viewer questions. But before that, for those watching on the Real Vision website, first, thank you. If you haven't signed up yet, check it out at realvision.com/crypto. That's realvision.com/crypto. That's the best way to get early access to Real Vision content. And it's always free Real Vision crypto content, I should say. Tomorrow, you'll be able to watch the latest Raoul's Adventures in Crypto in full. Raoul spoke with Mike Novogratz of Galaxy Digital. You don't want to miss that. Again, that's realvision.com/crypto. And if you're watching on YouTube, please like and subscribe and hit the notification bell as well. Okay, on to viewer questions for Joe. This one comes to us from Paul on the Real Vision website. CoinDesk estimates that over 29,000 jobs have been cut across the crypto industry since April of last year. With all of these recently unemployed crypto workers, do you expect we'll see them back in the space with their own projects starting up? I love that question. Paul is clearly an optimist, talking about this kind of almost Schumpeterian creative destruction. When you see people get laid off, maybe they open up their own shops. Joe, what do you think about this as someone who invests in those private companies?
Absolutely. We are seeing, I think in the 2008, 2010 recession, what you saw was there were a lot of layoffs, and then amongst them were a lot of new innovation, new companies being born. And some of those have finally matured by 2020. They went public, amongst them, some of the IPOs we've seen. You're seeing another round of layoffs now in traditional tech. And so, whether we've seen like the mega tech companies have laid off, and some of the newer tech companies are laying off workers. And I don't think we've seen the worst in layoffs in technology, because based on what I'm hearing, what I'm seeing in the private markets, many startups, venture-backed startups, are trying to cut costs, employee costs, so that they kind of extend their cash runway a little bit longer. And right now, it's really hard to raise money, whether it's equities or debt. Equities because the VCs have slowed down because their LPs aren't investing as much. Debt because, as we mentioned earlier, private credit yields have just become so expensive at more than 10% a year, 12% a year. And a lot of companies don't want to pay that, so they have to.
And that reflects tightening financial conditions or the perception of increased default probability.
Exactly, and that's where you sort of can connect startup operations and macroeconomics together. Startups are just. I think what the startups are trying to do is they're trying to raise some equity or debt, and they're also trying to cut some cost. So hopefully both will kind of work in their favor to strengthen their balance sheet and extend their cash runway. Now, I would put Web3 and blockchain companies in the same bucket as tech companies because they're just companies, right? Companies have revenue, they have cash, and they have to pay for employees. So I would say that framework, that logic applies to Web3 companies. So just like 10 years ago, you had a lot of tech executives come on to start new companies, I would expect a lot of Web3 and company executives, employees kind of start new companies or join new companies. So I think there will be a lot more layoffs this year. Amongst them, there'll be many talented entrepreneurs and engineers starting new companies. You know, myself, I'm talking to several as we speak. And you know, I think another thing that I have really kind of realized recently is it's really hard to innovate when you work for a company. Like to innovate, to build a new product, you really have to come out on your own to build something and then either be acquired or go IPO. So, you know, I expect there will be many, many new entrepreneurs coming to the market this year.
Yeah, by the way, it's one of the reasons why I stay at Real Vision. They do allow us to innovate here. And even my crazy ideas sometimes become part of the show.
Hey, everyone, we're going to take another quick break and hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back to the Real Vision Crypto Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Joe, you talked about this sort of interaction between private markets and macroeconomics. This is what your specialty is and what we're always pleased to have you on to talk about. Interestingly enough, Ralph on the Real Vision website asks a question that is precisely in that wheelhouse. How bad has the impact of FTX and other negative crypto news been on private equity investor sentiment in the space? That is a great question. I'm very curious to hear how folks who are allocating to you guys think about exactly that question, what you've heard from them.
Yeah, so there's two sides to the question. One is how has that impacted LPs, investments in venture capital and private equity funds? LPs are, you know, sovereign wealth funds, family offices, endowments, pensions, et cetera. They're the allocators that allocate between private equity, private credit, public markets. And then the second part of that question, of the answer is how the fund managers, the VCs and the PE guys are investing in startups. I would say, let me start with the first one, which is because tech has performed so well in the last like 10 years in the last cycle, tech, because it's, for example, let's say a pension fund allocates 80% to the stock market and 20% to venture and Web3. Let's say that has done so well, it's doubled, it's tripled. It's really become a bigger portion of the portfolio, but based on the laws of the pension, the bylaws, maybe some let's say it's a pension of a state. They only appropriate a certain percentage of investment dollars towards a certain asset class. Because tech and venture has done well, it's become, let's say, 30% now. So now the pension funds have to cut back and even sell some of their stakes in like these VC and PE funds to go back to that 20% budget. So that's why you're seeing it's been harder for VC and PE funds to raise LP money from the pension fund, the sovereign wealth fund, for that. That's one of the reasons. So now, because the VC and PE funds have less money become from their LPs, they're also investing less. So that's what contributes to one of the slowdown in sort of funding. Now, how does this FTX thing impact everything? It hasn't impacted traditional software fintech investing. It's impacted much more Web3 investing. And I think one is because investors are just fearful. B is they have to probably do much more diligence and probably their investment committee is forcing them to, you know, just, you know, triple the amount of due diligence. And some have even sort of stopped on what deploying to Web3. So it's one of the consequences of sort of this whole transmission mechanism.
By the way, I have to say, for viewers who are relatively new to the financial side of this, if you're listening to Joe and you're a little bit confused, don't worry about it. You're hearing about how private markets actually work, how they function, and what the mechanism is for allocation of capital. This is something that folks maybe who've just been involved in public markets, example on the equity side, just may not have heard of, understanding how sovereign wealth funds, how pension funds allocate in private markets is such an important piece of the financial puzzle, and something that makes markets very opaque for people who, you know, maybe have just heard, remember from their high school or college days, the overview of how investing works. Well, you know, people invest in, you know, in retail individuals invest in public markets. You know, you buy a share of Facebook if you believe that Facebook's revenues are going to increase based on the net present value of, you know, the company. This is really about how private markets work, and it's such an important explainer for people to get. And it's a really great to have you here unpacking this for us. I know it differs a bit by sector, by region, but give folks a little bit of an understanding of how big private markets are relative to public markets on the credit side, on the equity and side, and also a little bit about how those allocations work, for example, from sovereign hedge funds, from pension funds, and from other allocators, Joe.
Yeah, so it's private markets are much smaller than public markets, but they're much more dynamic. So I'll give you a few stats. So right now in the US and abroad, there's about 1,000 or so unicorns. These are private companies that are worth $1 billion or more. So from that, we can sort of extrapolate what's the market size. But I will say there's a few things that really changed in the private markets in the last sort of 10 or 12 years than in the 1980s and 90s. One is private companies are can stay private longer.
Right.
And so what that means, they can raise more private funding and stay private longer. And staying private longer has its benefits. It's because you don't have to deal with the day-to-day fluctuations in the stock price, quarterly earnings. You can really focus on execution. And one of the factors that lengthened sort of helped private companies stay private longer was, I think during the Obama administration, they sort of increased the number of investors that can hold shares in the private company from.
This is the Reg A plus legislation that was really so important in changing those dynamics.
Right. So I clearly recall in 2012 when Facebook had to go public, I remember reading an article where they said Facebook now has more than 100 investors. They have to go public. Well, now that number is up to 500. So what that means is you can be, so if Facebook, right. All things equal, Facebook might have stayed private, you know, hypothetically. So private companies are staying private longer. There's right. A renewed interest in entrepreneurship.
Yes.
Which is people can work remote, tech has enabled a lot of new companies. And then in terms of allocations, let's call it a pension fund. Let's call it a US state's pension fund. Based on the bylaws of the pension fund and what that state's legislature appropriated, a pension fund can invest in several asset classes, the stock market, the bond market, public markets, real estate, cash, and private markets. Private markets is divided into private equity, LBO buyouts, venture capital, and I know Web3 is counted as a part of venture capital now for these pension funds. And so there's a percentage that the government has mandated that these pension funds to hold.
So a maximum, a ceiling, essentially, so that they don't get excessive exposure to highly illiquid assets.
So exactly. So in that context, sometimes these numbers go out of balance. So let's say the venture market has outperformed and doubled. Well, that percentage has doubled, all things equal. So then now the pension fund has to either invest less or sell some of those stakes to go back to the percentages.
This is essentially portfolio rebalancing. As you get outperformance on your private investments, they become a larger percentage of the portfolio. You got to sell them down to meet your mandates in terms of regulatory and compliance components. By the way, lest people think that this is kind of an academic discussion about how to lower average weighted cost of capital and return on equity, the way that this affects you as an investor, if you're a retail investor, is with a challenge on this, the sort of the flip side, the dark side of all this. Obviously, it increases the ability of companies and entrepreneurs to raise capital. It has a lot of positive side effects. But one of the negative components of this is companies staying private for longer has effectively shifted a lot of the value creation to the earlier part of the cycle. VCs have gotten very rich, and where you might have been able to buy a company here in the public markets, invest early in it. Now, because it's coming as a more mature company to the market, some of that hockey stick-like growth potential that you would be hoping for as an investor has already been realized in the private markets. That's the challenge. That's the balancing act here that regulators, that companies, and that investors are always trying to dynamically sort out in their minds when they invest.
Absolutely agreed. And so the private markets are booming, and I think that includes, you know, Web3 companies, blockchain companies, and we're seeing a lot of good activities, and, you know, I'm really excited to be in this industry.
Yeah. Joe, this is an incredible conversation. You're one of the few people out there who can wrap together macroeconomic conditions and what happens in early stage investing in the most entrepreneurial and dynamic companies. Very often these are seen as just totally different tracks. You're one of the few people who can really bring this together for our viewers. We always appreciate you coming here, and I hope we can do this again soon. Let me ask you this. We've covered a tremendous amount of ground here, broad array of topics we've discussed. Final points, key takeaways that you'd like to leave our viewers and listeners with.
Yeah, so I think starting with macro is, we are heading to a market, we are in the market reset and likely a recession, but it will not be a severe recession. It would probably be like a mild recession. It's kind of like a common cold. It's not a severe flu, you know, if you analogize the economy to a human being. So what that means is this is a healthy reset for the market. And so this allows the market to kind of consolidate and build for the next bull market, you know, fingers crossed in the next 5 to 10 years. The second is, in sort of blockchain Web3, there's still a lot of innovation that's happening. I think, you know, with these layoffs, there's going to be a lot of new companies being born. Private companies in this new on this new platform that can survive this kind of, you know, this reset will come out the other side stronger. And the way they survive is either by to increase more cash on the balance sheet or cut costs. And then on the private market side, we're seeing this whole AI becoming a platform that enables many new companies to be built on top of the AI platform. I think the same is going to happen with blockchain, and I think that's what. So despite all the, you know, market sort of negativity, there's actually a lot to look forward to.
Yeah, very well said. I'll keep my takeaways very short, and there are 3 points that Real Vision viewers and listeners already know. First, of course, is that macro matters. I think it's very easy sometimes for people who are very passionate about technology, who are very passionate about developing in the Web3 space, to forget about the fact that there is a macro substrate here that matters tremendously in terms of availability of credit, in terms of availability of equity capital, and all of the rest that Joe has just talked about here, incredibly important points. Secondly, I would say private markets are an incredibly interesting aspect of this space. And if you're interested in understanding what's happening in Web3, if you're interested in what's happening in digital assets more broadly, you have to understand a little bit how private markets work, because it's guys like Joe who are talking to allocators, who are being that bridge, who are allocating capital, assessing risk, figuring out where the opportunities are. Such an important point. And finally, third, something else that we're passionate about here on Real Vision is AI. Obviously, this is a topic that is increasingly important across the tech space, across the investing space, and more broadly, I think, across the business and traditional sort of, you know, general news landscape. This is a story that's going to affect everything. And I believe that Web3 and digital assets will be no exception. Joe, really a pleasure to have you here. I hope we can do this again soon, man.
Thanks so much, Ash. Great being here today.
I should say, for those of you watching on YouTube, like, subscribe, and please hit the notification bell. That way you can always stay up to date with the latest crypto news and analysis from Real Vision Crypto. If you're not yet a Real Vision Crypto subscriber, don't forget, it's free. Head over to realvision.com/crypto today. That's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow with the latest technical analysis from Dave the Wave. See you at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, 5 p.m. London time, live on Real Vision Crypto Daily Briefing. Have a great afternoon, everybody.